What's going on in the world today, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to Southern Sense Talk Radio with your host, Annie, the Radio Chickie Bellis, and featuring Curtis C.S. Bennett and the most interesting guests that you'll find anywhere on internet radio. So sit back, relax, and remember, Southern Sense is common sense.
All right, and welcome to another adventure here on Southern Sense. You're listening live, and I actually made a list of all the places you can find us, such as Facebook Live, YouTube Live, LinkedIn, Twitch, X, or Live, as well as Substack, Buzzsprout, Blog Talk Radio, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, iHeartRadio, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Pocket Cast, Deezer, Listen Notes, and Player FM. All in one breath.
I lost track at like 5.
Well, we're getting up there. We're getting the word out and getting the word around. And welcome again. We've got ourselves a great show lined up. We've got my friend Gregory Wrightstone joining us. He has a new book out. It came out actually in December, but we've been ships passing in the night. It's called A Very Convenient Warming, How Modest Warming and More CO2 Are Benefiting Humanity. So Gregory will be joining us at the first half of the show. And at the second half, we have from the Heritage Foundation, Daniel Cochran. And he is the Senior Research Associate for the Tech Policy Center at Heritage Foundation. So we've got ourselves a jam-up show and a lot to talk about. But have you heard the latest we have going on with RFK Jr., who is running for president as an independent? Have you heard this yet? That he says that doctors found a dead worm in his brain.
Oh, yeah, I heard that.
Now, if it came out of Joe Biden, I can understand that.
I mean, was he serious or was he just joking?
No, he was serious. He had a problem with experiencing memory loss and mental fogginess so severe that a friend grew concerned and suggested he might have a tumor, because you remember his uncle, Senator Edward Kennedy, passed away from a brain tumor. So he went around to a bunch of doctors, and they all said, yeah, we think you may have a brain tumor. So the doctor that worked on his uncle, Ed Kennedy, was the one who was going to operate on him. But just before going into surgery at Duke University, he got a phone call saying, no, we think it's a dead parasite that may have eaten part of your brain. And that's what it turns out to have been. We lost you again, Curtis. You check your connection. Check your mic connection again. But Kennedy is, that's one of the reasons why they're saying that he made a big show about, you know, being shown skiing down the slope with the, also lifting weights and things like that to show how healthy he is. I don't know if I want to elect someone missing part of their brain. I don't know about you, Curtis. Oh, then again, we elected Joe Biden. And again, we got no sound on you, Curtis. There's something wrong with your headset connection. And nothing's coming across. I don't know what it is, Curtis, but check it again because something's wrong with that headset. Maybe for Christmas I'll get you a new headset. Nope, nothing yet. Nothing yet. Well, Curtis tries to figure out what's going on with his headset. That's one of the items that crossed my desk. The other is that the cases against Donald Trump seem to be falling apart, left and right. It looks like Judge Cannon has indefinitely postponed the trial in Florida for the documents that Jack Smith has brought against him. It seems that some of the photographs offered into evidence purporting that he has these unauthorized documents were staged. So there's some question as to the chain of custody and other items dealing with that. Let's unmute you, Curtis, and see if you're back with us. Come on, unmute. Why won't you unmute? He's not letting me unmute you, Curtis. There we go.
Check one, check two.
Yeah, we got you. We got you back.
All right.
Yeah, I was discussing with the listeners that it seems like the cases against Trump are starting to fall apart little bit by little bit with the delay of the case in Florida for the documents. Judge Cannon has an indefinite delay, which means if it does go to trial, it would be next year after the election. There was some question as to false assertions of compliance with their discovery obligations. Basically, they're saying they believe some of this evidence was staged.
Oh, yeah, and I believe it. I mean, I've always contended that Trump, as president, has the legal authority to determine what's classified and what isn't. Not only that, his classified material was there at Mar-a-Lago, protected by Secret Service.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike what happened with Biden and his garage, and the fact that the vice president doesn't have the same authority.
Nor does the senator. He had documents dating back to the 70s.
Right. So, but they gave him a get out of jail, you know, free card. So.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And now Stormy Daniels, 2 days of testimony. And oh my goodness, I swear MSNBC and CNN were drooling over her. How she looks so virginal. This woman was a porn star who did 250 movies having sex with individuals and selling herself to it. I'm sorry. And now suddenly they're all oohing and eyeing over how virginal she looked. She's a porn star.
Well,
250 movies she made having sex with other individuals. And those movies were sold to people that they could watch in the comfort of their own home or wherever. I'm sorry.
What I can't get my head around is the fact that there is documentation where she says none of that happened.
Mm-hmm.
None of it. So if that's written down and it's known that, you know, she professed to not having a relationship with him. It was all made up. How did we get to this point?
Exactly. And wait a minute. Isn't that called, I believe, called perjury? If you lie under oath?
Yeah, true.
And she signed several documents, numerous documents, stating that it never happened, that this was not hush money. Meanwhile, she owes Trump over $500,000 in a court case that was reversed. So, I'm sorry. And then asked, does she hate him? Oh, she admits it. Yes, on the stand. And when she found he was indicted, that she was drinking champagne in celebration. Oh, wait a minute. She talks to dead people, too, and lived in a house that was haunted.
Well, let me get this straight. Nothing happened between them. So, why does she hate him?
And if nothing happened between them, how was it that she could describe the pajamas he was wearing, the mahogany furniture, the tiled floor?
Does she have proof of that, though?
Yeah. Does she have proof of that? Has anyone gone to that room number to document whether or not that was the way it was decorated?
At least Monica Lewinsky saved the dress.
Oh, that's right. Porn stars don't wear any clothing. So there's no clothing to save.
Wow.
I mean, the woman has absolutely no credibility. And she writes a book, and yet she says nothing happened. And then on court, she says something did happen. And then she tells a bunch of people in her book and in the affidavits that he was a gentleman, he bought her dinner, he discussed her going on The Apprentice. But then she didn't make it onto The Apprentice. You don't know which end of the story to catch her at. And then yet Michael Cohen, a known convicted perjurer, being brought to the stand. Mm. And what does the fact whether or not Trump did or did not have a relationship in some form with her have to do with this case? This case is about an accounting error, if you want to call it that. Where he put it in as personal expense when you're saying, no, it was hush money. I'm sorry. Whatever the hush money was for, that's irrelevant. That's completely irrelevant. What is relevant is the accounting.
Mm-hmm.
or that they claim is illegal.
Well, you know, they want to...
But it's beyond the statute of limitations.
They want to smear him.
Yeah.
With smear. So that people won't want to, you know, vote for him.
And as we discussed last week, normally prosecutors bring in their heavy hitters as the first two or three witnesses. We don't see that here. And instead, the prosecution is offering such a limp case that even if this jury was so anti-Trump, they're going to have a hard time finding a conviction. All you need is one juror. Mm-hmm. One juror. And the case gets thrown out. And he's got a very easy way of challenging it, because Judge Marchant, his daughter made millions of dollars off of Trump and as an anti-Trumper. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Every single judge I've seen interviewed by MSNBC, CNN, and so forth have said he should have recused himself from the get-go. He should never have presided on the bench on this trial. But like Erdogan, he wanted TV camera time. He wanted his face on the TV. But now even Erdogan is under investigation for the manner in which he handled Trump's case. He's under ethics violations investigation. And we're seeing case after case after case, Fannie Willis being brought up on ethnic investigations, possibly ethics charges and disbarment. So Florida's sinking, Georgia's sinking, and New York is sinking, all trying Trump.
Well, the thing about it is, from the beginning, when they were running for office, they ran on the theme that we're gonna you know, get Trump and put him in jail,
which is highly unethical.
It is. It is.
Highly unethical. You're saying that even though
there's prejudicial to their case now.
Yeah, this is a conviction in search of a charge. And who was it, Stalin, that said, "Show me the person, and I'll prove a crime." Mother Teresa would have been found guilty with these people.
Oh yeah.
And I'm glad I'm seeing it come, and people are understanding now this is a political persecution, plain and simple. And what does Trump do? He keeps on fighting. He's going to be in Wildwood, New Jersey tomorrow at a Trump rally. He's like a Timex, takes a lick and keeps on kicking.
Well, I'll tell you who won't be there, Chris Christie.
Will that man ever, please go away. With that said, anyone that listens to the show knows that we start off each and every show with a dedication to a fallen hero. And today's dedication is going to go out to Lieutenant Milton, and I'm trying not to mispronounce his name. I have it right here. Lieutenant Milton Resendez of the San Benito Police Department in Texas. His end of watch was Tuesday, October 17th of 2023. And this is from myrgv.com, written by Fernando Del Valle. And he writes, after her daughter Danella was born, San Benito Police Lieutenant Lupe Andrade made many in this close-knit community, asked Lieutenant Milton Resendez to become her child's godfather. Over the years, Resendez, who didn't have children, became godfather to 11 children, his obituary reads. He became the first San Benito police officer killed in the line of duty after he was shot during a fierce, hours-long pursuit stretching from a South Padre Island beach to Brownsville, where authorities arrested two men who are now facing capital murder charges. Andrade, who had been helping Melissa Resendez, the slain officer's wife, plan his funeral arrangements. She said, "This hits at a deeper level. He was more than my fellow lieutenant, more than my co-worker and colleague. He baptized my daughter. He was my daughter's godfather, so he was part of my family too. He didn't have kids, so he really saw my daughter as his." The 27-year veteran of the police department, Resendez's killing has stunned the town of 25,000. Inside the department, his death is tearing wounds deep within its 50 officers. The department's torn police chief, Mario Perea, said, "We're all with heavy hearts. Milton was part of our family. The department's hurting and the family's hurting. It's going to hurt for a long time." And from SBNewspaper.com by Ray Quintera. And he writes, "San Benito residents continue to mourn the loss of longtime San Benito police officer and native, Lieutenant Milton Resendez, who was killed in the line of duty on Tuesday night, October 17, 2023, in San Benito, during a vehicle pursuit on San Houston Boulevard. Lieutenant Milton Gabriel Resendez, 54, passed on October 18th of 2023, doing what he loved to do, protecting and serving his hometown of San Benito, Texas. He was a 26-year veteran of the San Benito Police Department. Resendez is a product of San Benito Public Schools, graduating as a member of the San Benito High School class of 1987, and attending Rangerville Elementary, as well as Miller Johnson and Berger Cabaza Middle Schools. He later attended Texas Southmost College and the Lower Rio Grande Valley Development Council Police Academy before joining the SBPD. Resendez was employed by the Brownsville Police Department, Palm Valley Police Department, and the San Benito CISD Police Department. All told, he served over 30 years in law enforcement. According to his obituary, he was an avid comic book and toy collector, a movie buff, and enjoyed gardening. He also enjoyed watching his favorite NFL teams, the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Houston Texans, as well as watching WWE wrestling. He also enjoyed music. His favorite band was Kiss. Resendez was born September 2, 1969, to Milton and Susanna M. Resendez, who preceded him in death. He survived by his wife, Melissa, whom he met while attending Texas Southmost College. They were married for 27 years upon his death. He's also survived by his siblings and numerous nephews and nieces. At around 3:30 p.m. on Friday afternoon, October 20th, 2023, an untold number of law enforcement personnel representing local, state, and federal agencies in a mile-long procession down Business 77, absent of civilian traffic, escorted Lieutenant Resendez's deceased body from Harlington Valley Baptist Medical Center to Buck Ashcroft Funeral Home in San Benito. And finally, from myrgv.com by Fernando Del Valle. And he writes, "In one of the city's biggest funeral ceremonies, hundreds of law enforcement officers joined Lieutenant Milton Resendez's family to honor San Benito's first police officer killed in the line of duty. As a big American flag fluttered high over San Benito Memorial Park, family members placed red roses on his casket more than a week after suspects shot him to death before a fierce, hours-long pursuit ended in the arrest of two men facing capital murder charges. Hundreds of law enforcement vehicles, with their lights flashing and sirens screeching, staged a historic half-hour procession from St. Benedict's Catholic Church, where Resendez's family held a funeral mass, down Bowie Street, then alongside Interstate 69's frontage road to Williams Road, before entering San Jose Ranch Road toward the cemetery off Sam Houston Boulevard. Over the ceremony, a Texas Department of Public Safety helicopter hovered, leading the way for three other choppers. Lieutenant Resendez courageously gave his life. A woman's voice echoed through loudspeakers as family members shed tears, hugging his wife, Melissa, under a long white canopy. The shrill of bagpipes filled the cemetery as officers representing law enforcement agencies from across the state played before Resendez's casket. It was an honor that our fallen hero was given so much dedication from all parts of the valley, the state, and the nation, Mayor Rick Guerra said under a tent. Standing near the family, City Commissioner Pete Galvin called it the biggest funeral he had ever seen in this town of 25,000 residents. "I've never seen anything like it," he said. "I hope we will never see it again." From across the Rio Grande Valley, law enforcement officers streamed into town. At 9 a.m., a solemn caravan of Hidalgo County law enforcement vehicles, stretching about a mile long, traveled into Cameron County with blue and red lights flashing. Near Hidalgo and Cameron County lines, a large digital Burt Ogden sign played a photo of Resendez paying tribute to the fallen officer during the morning commute. In San Benito, police blocked Sam Houston Boulevard up Bowie Street as hundreds of cars lined the narrow roads leading to St. Benedict's Church. As she walked down Bowie Street, former U.S. Rep. Myra Flores, a candidate for the congressional seat she lost last year, described Resendez as a lawman known for helping fellow officers. "He was loved everywhere," Flores said. A respiratory therapist from San Benito, whose husband serves as a Border Patrol agent. She said he helped everyone. Outside the church, hundreds of police officers from as far away as New York City, Boston, Florida, and Georgia stood in rows before lawmen carried Resendez's casket before the altar. Inside, the church filled with area leaders and law enforcement officers as they joined the family. At the podium, the Reverend Mario Avalos, the Brownsville Diocese Auxiliary Bishop, described the town as a wounded community. "Many questions arise when we have to experience death. A lot of very human questions," Avalos told the audience. "Why did it have to happen? Why did God allow this to happen? I'm sure some of you have these questions." That's a very human way to face what is death. "But we're not just human," he said. "We have a soul. We have hope and we have faith. And we have the only begotten Son of God who gave his life for us." Standing next to Resendez's portrait, Alvarez described him as a hero who gave his life for his community. Resendez, who didn't have children, was godfather to 11 children, his obituary states. "He was always generous with people throughout his work, throughout his life. He was able to give his time to be a godfather to all the children he had. His life was of service in many ways, life to the community, life to the people around him, and to the sacrifice. He gave his life for the people he loved, for his community," he said. "That's what you do when you're there protecting us. Milton died doing what he loved to do, protecting his hometown, and that will be taken into account by the Lord. It's a difficult time, but I am sure the Son was waiting for Milton." "The life of Milton Resendez should be an encouragement to all of us," he said. "This is not the end. This is the beginning. We will continue to honor the life of Milton and all those who have given their lives for others. Lieutenant Resendez courageously gave his life." Today's show is dedicated to Lieutenant Resendez. It is also dedicated to all the brave men and women out there that serve as first responders, be they law enforcement, firefighters, or emergency services. We also dedicate this show to the brave men and women out there that serve as first responders from the birth of this great nation through today and into our hopeful future. We dedicate to them this song by Tiffany, "Soul of the Nation." May God bless each and every one.
Let it be said, when we finished this race, we kept them free, we led with grace. Let it be seen, from sea to shining sea, beautiful America, living our legacy. Oh, to learn to love each other. Oh, for the soul of the nation, for all the next generation. Let us be known as people of honor, humble and bold, faithful through fire. Let us hold firm to our conviction with wide open hearts, eager to
back. My co-host Curtis C.S. Bennett and myself, Henny, the Radio Chickadee, and we're here with our guest of the day, my first, my only, no, not my first, but Gregory Wrightstone. Good afternoon, Gregory. How are you today?
Yeah, very good. It's been quite a while, Annie.
Hey,
Greg. Yeah, it has been. But, you know, every time I contacted AJ to do something, you were traveling, you were doing this, you were doing that, and I just figured you didn't love me anymore.
Oh, it's not that I don't love you. I don't love you anymore. I don't love you any less. I'm just, those of you listening, Annie was my first interview. I ever went back in, I think, 2017, right after I published my first book. And so we have a history. So I love being on with you. I'll be on with you just about any time as long as I'm available. I will be traveling actually to the Netherlands, to Amsterdam in a few weeks. My new book is being published in Dutch. We'll be doing a book tour of Europe and mainly the Netherlands. So it's been pretty interesting.
Well, I'm just wondering if you're going to have it also in Russian, so your CEO of the CO2 coalition can read it in Russian. He reads it in Russian.
It is looked at hopefully in Portuguese soon. The first book was in Norwegian. That book was Mok Vakt Fakt on Klima.
It didn't sound right.
Inconvenient Facts in Norwegian. So it's been quite a ride.
Well, your new book is called A Very Convenient Warming, How Modest Warming and More CO2 Are Benefiting Humanity. And in Amazon, as well as on your website, which is convenientwarming.com. We also have your own website, which is gwrightstone.com, as well as inconvenientfacts.xyz. See, I remember all this.
Boy, you're good. That's Joe Biden moment for you.
We were talking about Robert F. Kennedy admitting that he had a worm eat part of his brain. I said, well, if it was Joe Biden, I can understand. But I got to say something. As I was reading the book, as you know I do, I was absolutely floored and flabbergasted. And I don't know if you know, I'm newlywed. I just remarried recently. And I had to rush over and say, look, you got to read this. You got to read this paragraph. Do you know that name? Do you recognize that name there? Then I ran over to my mom and I'm showing it to her. I says, do you recognize that name there, Mom? She says, I don't know that person. But in your acknowledgments, you acknowledged me as being your first interview. And that was just so very, so very touching. And that floored me. That is the second time someone acknowledged me in their book. And that really blows my mind.
Well, we've got a special bond there, Annie. So I love talking with you.
Well, you know, this book is actually a follow-up, and you expound a little bit on your first book. And it's not written for idiots. It's for the average person to understand why the climate change is a hoax. And, gosh, I don't even know where to start with this one. I've got a whole mess of notes here. You break the book down into three sections. Why three sections? So the first one is the basic climate facts.
Well, we needed to establish that first. What's actually going on? And so I took a look at that. And I also looked at, in that section, we said, well, what are they talking about? Particularly, let's just say, heat waves. The claim is heat waves are getting worse and worse and worse, and the summers are getting hotter, and people are dying. So I took a look at actually what the data says, and the data disputes that strongly, and particularly in the continental United States and around the world, some of the hottest temperatures were 80 and 90 years ago. We are in a warming trend, but a lot of that warming is being driven by higher temperatures of nighttime coldest temperatures, if you follow me. That, let's say you're living in Wyoming, and your average temperature in December 80 years ago was 10 degrees. And now the average temperature for December is 15 degrees. Well, if you're at 5 degrees, makes a big difference. And that kind of, it lifts up. So what we see is actually not increases in extreme heat, but rather moderation of extreme cold, which is a very good thing. And it's extending growing seasons, which is great for agriculture. And it's what we should celebrate that. And what we're seeing is this combination of modest warming. This is the guts of the book, is this modest warming combined with more CO2 and driving huge benefits to our ecosystems.
But aren't we climbing out of a mini ice age?
Yeah, it was during the Little Ice Age, which took place from about 1250 to 1850. It was a 500-year period. It was probably the coldest temperatures of the last 10,000 years. And so that was a horrific period for humanity. And that was in the second section of the book where I deal with that, where I deal with the relationship between human history and climate history to find that the warmer periods were hugely beneficial to humanity. And it was the cold periods, the intervening cold that were just horrific. We found that each of the cold periods were correlated to crop failure, pestilence, mass depopulation. These were horrible times. So we're climbing out of the depths of that little ice age, and we're warming. And we've warmed about 1.2 degrees Celsius since that time. And now bear in mind, you've probably heard that we dare not get to 1.5 degrees of warming since that period back in the 1800s. Well, we've already warmed 1.2 degrees. So what does that mean? They're warning us against an additional 3/10 of a degree centigrade of warming. That's half a degree Fahrenheit of warming, or it's all over. Half a degree, it's probably changed. Where you're sitting in your studio has probably changed half a degree higher or lower since we started this interview. You never knew it. Half a degree Fahrenheit won't trigger a thermostat on or off. And if you're that worried about half a degree Fahrenheit, which is what their warning is about, just move 19 miles farther north and your average temperature would drop by half a degree. Come on, man. At that point, what they're warning us about is just ridiculous.
Well, you know, there's so many. I've got notes scribbled all over the place. You know me. I keep on telling people that the earth was warmer when Christ walked on it. And I also find it amazing that you had the little ice age that started, let me get these dates, at 1250 AD to 1850. And yet we saw the largest amount of exploration in that mini ice age.
Yes, they did. But it was a horrific period. It wasn't when we were exploring. And this little ice age didn't affect all of the nations of the world. You see, for example, the Enlightenment took place during that period. And there were a lot of, like you say, a lot of those ships that sailed were from the Mediterranean nations. And it was Northern Europe that experienced the worst of this little ice age. And so with the Mediterranean climates, the Mediterranean, the oceans moderate temperatures. They weren't nearly as affected. If you look at the Germans, the French, the Norwegian countries, Greenland, Iceland, and China in particular, particularly this cold really affected them.
Gregory, isn't it true, or do you believe that the left uses this as a way to control other people's behavior or the things that we do? And they say, well, it's for a good cause, you know, it's for the environment, it's for the climate.
Yeah, there's no doubt that this is what they're proposing. Is they're removing your freedoms one by one by one, mm-hmm. and they're doing it very quickly. They're controlling, using climate change, a false climate crisis claim, climate change to remove your freedoms and to control every aspect of your life. They've already told you how much water can come out of your toilet, how much water can flow out of your shower head. They're trying to tell you now what kind of car to drive, how to heat your home, how to cook your meals. They're telling you what kind of a ceiling fan to buy.
They got rid of incandescent light bulbs.
And light bulbs are already gone, right? Incandescent light bulbs, sayonara, they're already gone. So it's about control. I'm often asked, why are they doing it? Why are they lying to us? And you know, I can't see inside men's and women's souls to see what their motivation is. But as a scientist, it's my job to say, okay, this is what they're telling you, and here's the science, here's what the facts are. And you can decide pretty quickly that Wrightstone's right. He's backing this up with data. And these guys like Al Gore and John Kerry and the other climate grifters are lying to us. So we need to expose this. And I'm very optimistic when I talk to people, just random people that I talk to are just thirsty for this information.
Well, your partner, Dr. William Happer, cited Plato's Republic, which, yes, I did read many years ago, The Noble Lie. And that's what we're talking about. You know, its purpose is to lead the public alarm. And we see this time and time again. But at one point, wasn't climate change blamed on some witches?
Well, that was that was during the Little Ice Age. As it started getting cold, we lived the medieval warm period. It was the high Middle Ages. Life was good. Food was bountiful. The human condition was improved and improving. And then it started getting cold. And when it started getting cold, crops began to fail. Famine set in. People started dying. And as is wont, people looked around for who to blame, just like we are today. Back then, they blamed weather-causing witches for causing frosts and famine and the like. And there were, in fact, in the book, I've got a chart. I show the top of the chart shows the number of witches killed per decade. And the bottom was really cold temperatures. And it was the colder they got, the more witches they killed because more people were dying. And what were the witches today? They're pointing at us. And I live a high carbon lifestyle. I'm proud. They'll point and go, you're the witch. You're the witch. You're causing runaway warming. You're causing heat waves. You're causing the oceans to rise. We're all going to die because of you and Annie Eubellis and C.S. Bennett. The rest, you're all witches. We need to pillory you and put you in jail for speaking out. But in this case, the witches, the witch hunts, actually, there were thousands of so-called witches killed at that time because they were plain. It was really climate change and cold that were killing all these people, leading to the famines and crop failures. And it started out in Europe, in the United Kingdom, Germany, France, Northern Europe. It started raining when it started getting cold, just completely opposite. We're being told drought and heat waves will kill us. It just started raining and it wouldn't stop. And they couldn't get the crop. This started, they lived the subsistence lifestyle. They could, they grow food and they keep it from 1 year to the next. They could survive one bad harvest or maybe two, but four or five, one back to back to back to back just was a killer for them. And that's what we saw. Just the temperatures dropped, it started raining, wouldn't stop. Anything got planted, didn't ripen, it rotted in the fields in the fall. It was a bleak existence for these people. And again, it's just the opposite of what we're being told. We're being told, fear the heat. But no, I say welcome the warmth and fear the cold. That's what history tells us. And people like Dr. Michael Mann and Al Gore, John Kerry, Greta Thunberg, they'll call me a climate denier. I'll call them a history denier. They're denying what's actually happening between human history and temperature history.
Well, they pull out all these models and they say, well, we have done this study and it's showing that, hey, you're wrong. But their models are all based upon faulty data, isn't it?
Well, it's not that the data is false. The models are predictive models that they can plug. It's a plug and play thing. And these models are using estimates of warming. And then when we actually, they start with an okay warming, but then they multiply it with factors. They say, oh, well, warming is going to cause more water vapor in the atmosphere, and then that's going to multiply the warming effect. So what we end up with is we can use these models and see, back to 1980 or so, when we start getting the satellite data. Okay, here's what the CO2 did. We'll plug in those models. What does the model say what the temperature should be now? And we can plot that out over the last 40 years, which has been done, and then compare that to actual temperatures that we've measured. We're using satellites and weather balloons and some accurate information, and find that they're over-predicting warming by 2.5 to 3 times too much. And so even the people running these models have admitted that what we saw, that we call it, that it's running too hot. And so that's what they're basing a lot of these predictions of catastrophic failure on, completely inaccurate.
Well, in the 1970s, when we were in school, it was all the world was going too cold. We're going to freeze to death. And everyone was afraid, oh, we got to do something about the climate. And I think because someone realized this is a multi-trillion dollar business, let's use this model now. Well, it's not that we're getting too cold. Temperatures are starting to rise. So now it's global warming. And it's a trillion dollar business, isn't it?
Yeah, and when that's instructive, just when we started adding a lot of CO2, it was really in that mid-20th century in the post-World War II economic boom, is when, if you're going to see warming from, driven by human emissions, it should be starting about that time. But just as we started adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere in significant amounts, we went into a 33-year cooling period from the mid-1940s until the late 1970s, 33 years of cooling, all the while CO2 is increasing. Wait a minute. CO2 drove warming, not cooling. And so we had this conundrum of rising CO2 and lowering of temperatures. And yes, I was in college in the mid and late 70s, and those winters at Waynesburg University, really, really, really cold. But right after that, starting in 1978, 79, we started entering into this current warming trend that we're on. And it's thankfully warming. I like it. I've just moved to the free state of Florida. I'm in my home there now, and it's I enjoy a little bit of warmth. In fact, I enjoy a lot of warmth. I'm glad to. People are moving to the warm climates. You ever meet anyone that wants to move to Wales? No, thank you. It's Wales, Scotland,
Alaska. Nice day.
My grandma was a McQuaid, but so I'm Scottish, but I didn't want to live there.
Oh, man. It's a fantastic book. But everyone's saying, well, wait a minute, climate change, it's causing more storms, more wildfires. And they use what happened in Maui, Hawaii. And I'm sorry, Maui fire occurred because the power company was irresponsible. People did not keep up the crops of pineapples. Instead, they allowed wild weeds grow in there that didn't even belong there. And no one did good stewardship of the land in making sure that the dead vegetation was taken out. So in case the power company had a electrical strike, or heaven forbid, a lightning strike, this dry vegetation, it was just going to flare up. And I don't know, but it was climate change. They did it. Not pure bad stewardship.
Yeah, there were a lot of things that went into this. The mountains there above Lahaina, they experienced the same type of things. You've heard of the Santa Ana winds and the Diablo winds of California, where they come rushing down towards the sea. And as they're rushing down, they're gaining speed and gaining heat and drying out. And that's what the Santa Ana winds caused, are the main causes of those horrible fires in the grassland areas of California. And we see the same thing at Lahaina. We had the same event. They call it the Lahaina winds that come down periodically. And all the pineapple groves that they've been growing, Dole and others had huge pineapple plantations that are no longer there. And so they've been allowed to grow with invasive grasses, like you said. And so now you get these grasses. These grasses can dry out completely in less than 2 hours with this hot, dry wind. And that's what we saw. And that wind comes rushing down, knocked over power lines, sparks, fire, and those winds just roared right into town. It's not the first time it's happened. It happened in the 1800s and wiped out most of the same city. It's not a recent event. It will happen again unless they can do some preventive measurements. Bury the power lines, number one. Do active management of the grasslands so they don't have the fuel to go ahead and fuel these fires. They're common sense things we can do. We do know, though, that wildfires, and I capture that in the book, they've definitely been in decline globally by a lot. And we saw that in 1983, the first Copernicus satellite went up and they captured that data. And so for the first time, we can have global accurate measurements of acreage burn. And it's been a declining since that first satellite went up. Now, 40 years of data that we can confirm that. We see it throughout the information we have for the United States, continental United States, where 20% of both number and area burned to fires as we were 80 and 90 years ago. Completely opposite of what you're being told.
But they're also saying, no, we've got a lot more storms, a lot more hurricanes than this. But isn't there something called El Nino that's stirring up every so many years? You will see an increase in storm, but then once El Nino goes away and La Nina comes in, everything goes nice and quiet. Let us women calm things down.
Well, we got, no, the fact of the matter is, I capture also in the book, I look at the UN MDAT data, Center for Disaster Preparedness. We can look at the tornado data and find out that tornadoes, for sure, the big ones, the F3, F4, F5 tornadoes, have been in a significant decline. And it's because you see a lot of these storms aren't driven by temperature increases. It's actually differentials of temperature that cause these terrible thunderstorms and tornadoes. It's the difference between very hot and with tornadoes underneath, warm Gulf Coast, moist, warm air, and then over top of it or is a cold air mass coming over the Rocky Mountains that's fueling these tornadoes. That's what fuels it. Not it's not that the entire temperatures increase, but it's the differential in temperatures. We see that the best measurement in the United States and really worldwide are landfalling hurricanes. It's difficult to get a long-term measurement of hurricanes because before the satellite data, we could get hurricanes that would spring up out in the ocean. We never knew about it. But going back, we can confidently count every single landfalling hurricane that's hit the United States. They're hard to miss. And from 1850 on, if a landfall made hurricane, we knew about it. And we using this landfalling hurricane data, we see that they've actually been in decline. I looked at all the states on the Gulf Coast and Atlantic seaboard. And every single state except Mississippi had a decrease in landfalling hurricanes. And we also see that in that database of natural disasters, since they built it out in the year 2000, we've seen a 10% decline. We've also seen a greater than 90% decline in natural disaster deaths. So again, it's opposite of what you're being told. We're seeing a decline in deaths related to natural disasters.
All right, now everyone's saying CO2 is bad. Now I have to admit, I tore the house apart looking for my I love CO2 button and it seemed to walk away. So I got to get you to send me a new CO2 button. But okay. You call it in the book a miracle molecule. And yet everyone else says CO2 is really, really bad. It's causing all these bad things to happen. And yet you demonstrated in your book with a fir tree where you deprived it of CO2, and then in different stages, you increase the amount of CO2 coming in. And CO2 is a good thing, isn't it?
Oh, it's we call it the miracle molecule. The CO2 Coalition, I'm executive director now, our unofficial motto is, we love CO2 and so should you. And it's been marvelous with driving the greening of the earth, increase in vegetation, increases in forests. The greatest increase we see is agriculture. There are three things driving agriculture. And in my book, I take the eight largest crops in the world and look back 40 years, what's going on in their output, agricultural output from the eight top crops in the world, breaking records year after year after year after year. And it's due to three primary factors. Number one, of course, is increase of CO2. That increasing CO2 is the lower levels of CO2 that we had 100 and even 50 years ago didn't allow plants to grow to their full potential. Now with higher CO2 levels, that CO2 is just driving plant growth. The other thing is an increase in temperature. With more temperature, we have longer growing seasons. So killing frosts and earlier in the spring, arrive later in the fall. We have more harvests, killing frost don't hit. If you have an apple orchard, what do you fear the most? Late spring killing frosts. Mm-hmm. They'll just wipe you out for the year. Because of this warming, you have much lower chance of that occurring. And then the third thing is the use of nitrogen fertilizers. And these nitrogen fertilizers we started using significantly around 1950 after World War II. And that's a huge increase. And how do you create nitrogen fertilizers? Natural gas, primarily. These are fossil fuel derived nitrogen fertilizers, and they're helping feed a growing population. Also in my book, I capture that agricultural productivity is outpacing by a lot population growth. You'll hear these people, the problem is we have too many people on Earth. No, we don't. As long as we can keep continuing this increase of CO2 that's driving agricultural productivity, we have plenty of food to feed the world. So we can look at this and see that every nation nearly on Earth, from the coldest to the warmest, are benefiting from modest warming and more CO2. We should celebrate that.
Absolutely. And here in South Carolina, we realize we have an energy problem because our population and businesses are just getting out of hand. And they don't have enough energy. So they decide, hey, we're going to go back to the basics, back to the carbon-based fueling, you know, open up the coal plants, start up again with the nuclear plants, which they never finished from the 1970s. So they're looking at this, but everyone's going, you're going to create more global warming, and the seas are going to rise up, and the islands are going to disappear. That's not how Mother Nature works, is it?
No. And what we've got tight gauge records for South Carolina and Eastern, all around the world, and we can look at these records. And if increases in CO2 were driving warming and increases of sea level, we should be able to recognize these. These tight gauge records are very accurate and go back more than 100 years in many cases, some cases back into the 1800s. And we see that there's no acceleration in sea level rise. Is sea level rising? Yes. How much? 7 inches per century. 7 inches per century. And we're being told that these islands in the Pacific and the Caribbean are going to be underwater within a few decades. You've all heard that. And it's just stated as a fact. Okay, well, according to the UN, the most at-risk island, chain of islands, are the Maldives in the Indian Ocean, and they're only barely above sea level, 14 feet is their highest elevation. 15,000 years ago, the Maldives were also just above sea level. In the last 15,000 years, sea level has risen 400 feet. So Annie, you would ask me, well, Greg, why aren't those islands under 400 feet of water? And I would say, well, Annie, the answer is a geologic process known as accretion. As sea level rises, those islands actually grow. It's a near shore that forms, wash near shore sediments and gravels, pieces of the reef up onto the island. It's a slow process. The geology is a slow process. And these islands gradually grow as sea level rises. And so what they're telling us is the Maldives will be underwater by maybe 2050. But by 2050, at the current state rate of sea level rise, the sea level will have risen 3 inches. Okay. So what they're telling you is the last 400 feet of sea level rise didn't put those islands underwater. That next 3 inches, look out, that'll put them under. No, they won't. Come on, it's barely over your ankles.
Oh, man. You know, there's so much more to discuss in this book because it's absolutely excellent. A very convenient warming, how modest warming and more CO2 are benefiting humanity. Gregory, I am, again, honored to find that you put my name in your acknowledgments there. Mom goes, who's that? But we do have to talk because you did come to our Tea Party meeting. If you do head up this way, see if we can get you also to our county GOP meeting and sell some books for you. But people can find this at convenientwarming.com. GWriteStone.com. They can find you also at GWriteStone.com. And it's not banned in our libraries here as it is in Northland Library in Pennsylvania.
That's right.
Well, Gregory, I thank you for joining with us, and God bless you for the hard work you do. And we'll be talking soon. You know that. You know where I am.
All right, Annie. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Gregory Redstone. I mean, it's always fun to talk with him. We've had him on since 2017 when he first came on. And I got to tell you, before we bring our next guest on, a little intro, let him know that about 3 days after he showed up on my show for the very first interview we ever did, he was on Fox News. And I think someone at Fox News is still watching the show. With that said, welcome from the Heritage Foundation, Daniel Cochran. Good afternoon, Daniel. How are you today?
Great afternoon. It's good to be with you, and hope you're having a lighter day than I am. I'm here in Northern Virginia. It's rather rainy outside, but otherwise in good spirits.
We had our rain come through last night. We had also tornado warnings. So I was running around outside, you know, making sure everything was lying down so nothing goes flying through the area. But we walked away with just some bad thunderstorms. So you stay safe out there. You wrote with our friend, I love this man, Hans von Spakovsky. I just love saying his name. A great commentary dealing with election law reform. And this ties in with what is going on with TikTok. And last week I was, call it naive, but I was thinking out loud on the show saying, why would we ban TikTok if someone makes an informed decision as an individual? We tell everyone, hey, TikTok is controlled by the Communist Chinese Party. Yeah, you're monetizing yourself, but yeah, you're leaving your information exposed to the Chinese. But you make that decision as an adult. Because we have it here in South Carolina, they're trying to pass the internet law where under a certain age, you can't go on certain social websites. And I agree it should not be in any government computer, and corporations make that decision to ban it too. But when I read your article, I'm saying, you know, Annie, you're kind of stupid. You really didn't think this through. But you and Hans did. And tell me why I am wrong and you are right, because I'm kicking myself, honestly.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to be here. And I think the place to start is what Congress did was actually not ban TikTok. So it's not the legislation Congress passed is not a ban. What it simply says is if TikTok wants to continue to operate on U.S. soil, it can't be controlled by an entity under the influence of a foreign adversary. And that is very narrowly defined in the legislation to just a handful of countries, including China, which is, as your listeners know, run by the Chinese Communist Party. And so the law is not a ban. It has nothing to do with the app's content. It's simply its conduct. And the fact that the Chinese Communist Party under the laws of China can demand that ByteDance, which is the parent company that owns TikTok, that they can demand TikTok give them access to Americans' users' data. So I think that's the critical point. Number one, it's not a ban. It's requiring that the app not be owned by a foreign adversary. But the second point is to say that national security is a crucial interest that's been protected in U.S. law for decades. As far back as the 1920s or 1930s, the Radio Act specified that foreign entities couldn't own radio networks because at the time, radio, like social media today, was the platform where people were getting their information and news. And the U.S. government has always had a substantial interest in making sure that those technologies and platforms are not controlled by foreign entities with interests adversarial to the United States. So I think that's the critical point in terms of the bill. And I'll add one more layer on that, and this gets to the article that you read. There's another risk factor that TikTok presents, and that is the fact that its algorithm, and the way that it creates content, curates content, allows the Chinese Communist Party to dictate the information flows to our most vulnerable citizens, and that is our children. There's over 150 million users of TikTok in the United States alone. Many of those are people my age and younger. They're young people. They're people that are still forming their thoughts and ideas. And that's a really dangerous thing, if you think about it, to have a social media platform like TikTok under the control of China and able to influence so many young people around an election season. That's just a recipe for disaster on multiple levels.
Well, you know, as I was reading the article you wrote with Hans, and then this with that appeared in the Washington Examiner, and I urge people to honestly read this article titled "TikTok's New Election Integrity Plan is a Trojan Horse for Censorship," that the both of you wrote. It, and I was reading this one that you have in the Heritage, and big tech like Facebook and all the others, they do censor. They do call it moderate content that may or may not fit their idea of social norms. And I have been deplatformed on Facebook and YouTube numerous times. I keep on coming back and kicking. So I have the badge of honor there with that. And it is frustrating where you know what you're doing out there. You're giving out information. You're giving out facts. But for some reason, they deem it doesn't follow there what they want you to see, and they will deplatform you, and you have no recourse.
That's exactly right, and this is a problem across the board. It's not just with TikTok, but with Facebook, as you mentioned, with Instagram. It used to be a much bigger problem with Twitter before Elon Musk bought it. But whenever you have concentrated power, especially over communications mediums, it represents a temptation, and that temptation is to use those platforms to suppress views and ideas that are out of step with the dominant narratives. And look, if your listeners are familiar with the Twitter files, or familiar with the fact that Louisiana and Missouri sued the Biden administration for putting pressure secretly on these companies to censor information around the last presidential election in 2020 and the COVID pandemic. Look, I mean, whenever you have this concentrated power and these groups, interest groups, can collude secretly to suppress it, it's always going to be a problem. And that's why we need to address that broadly. But with respect to TikTok, TikTok represents kind of a double threat. It's not just concentrated power, which is a problem in of itself, but it's even more addictive in some ways than are the American platforms. And it's in the hands of a foreign adversary. So that makes it a double threat. And that's why I think your listeners need to understand it's something we need to take seriously.
Yeah, because we know that they have been censoring information getting out. Forget about saying Tiananmen Square or the Tibetan independence or the Falun Gong. And we've had several broadcasts dealing with the Falun Gong. And every single time we do a broadcast, also in the middle of it, the internet goes down on us. So I'm saying, yes, the Chinese are listening to, even if it's not through TikTok, they are listening to us to see what we're talking about. And we know that they are trying to influence the elections by monitoring what they consider misinformation and then using artificial intelligence to recraft the message to what they want. So Joe Biden's perfectly healthy. There's nothing wrong with him. That was so Robert Kennedy Jr. that had the worm eating his brain. Biden's brain is perfectly fine. Yeah, this is what they're going to be doing to us in this upcoming election, isn't it?
Well, they've said as much. So they're hiring 40,000 content moderators. And by the way, when they say content moderators, that really means censors, because what those people are doing is they're making decisions. They're reviewing the content that users post. They're making decisions about whether that content stays up on the platform or is taken down. They're hiring 40,000 of these people ahead of November. Not only are they doing that, but they said they're going to partner with an organization called Democracy Works. Now, who is Democracy Works, right? Democracy Works, according to research by the Capital Research Center, is one of these quote unquote fact-checking organizations that is mainly aligned with and funded by left-wing donors. Left-wing donors are on their board. They're associated with another left-wing group called the Bridge Alliance. And these organizations have long been targeting honest debates and critiques of lax voting laws. Your listeners are probably familiar with the problem of ballot harvesting, right? All of these valid critiques, groups like Democracy Works have been going after. One of the ways they do that is they target these information intermediaries, companies like TikTok, and they go and say, hey, this is misinformation or disinformation. You need to take it off your platform. We know that happened in 2020. We know that happened even in the last couple years, especially, that the government was colluding with these platforms to take down speech that they didn't like. And look, the same thing's going to happen again this year.
Daniel, is it true that the TikTok material or content that our children are looking at is not what they show over in China to their young people?
Yes, that's right. So in China, they actually have a separate version of the app. And that version of the app actually shows kids science videos. It's designed to inspire creativity, inspire them to take their studies seriously. And something I should also mention is in China, there's time restrictions on the app. So whereas here, they're trying to incentivize kids to use this app as much as they possibly can for hours and hours on end. In China, they have limitations on how much their kids can use the app. I mean, isn't that kind of an ironic twist? It's pretty hypocritical. So essentially what that means is they've shipped us the toxic version of TikTok, right, to poison the minds of our kids, while they kept the good version of TikTok, if you can imagine such a thing, for their own population. That kind of tells you something about the danger of this app.
Man, I mean, we have TikTok, but you also have Google with a secret blacklist.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. And then Facebook has a covert whitelist called XCheck. And there was a leak from Google in 2018 that revealed the company can personalize search results and feeds to reinforce its values. And Google also has what they call voter education and mobilization. Now, Biden, when he came in office, signed an executive order, the Turn Out the Vote, authorizing federal agencies to encourage voter registration. And my mom got in the mail with her Medicare statement information on voter registration. Now, that doesn't mean this is going to people that are legal citizens here eligible to vote. So we also have now organizations such as Google and TikTok and everything else going after mobilizing the voters, but we don't know whether or not these are legal citizens to vote. So we have massive voter interference occurring at this very moment, not just several months from now. It was occurred in the last election, occurred in the election before that. It's occurring now.
Well, it's actually worse than that, because what Google has the ability to do is it can decide which users see their reminders. So Google will say, we're just making information available on elections to our users, and we're using our algorithms to decide how that information should be targeted. But what that means in practice is that Google has the ability to make sure that certain demographics, certain populations that they think support their political interests, see that message. And if you think about the millions and millions of people, I mean, basically everyone in America who uses Google, if you're talking about tight elections, that kind of micro-targeting on their platform, I mean, that could have a substantial impact. In fact, that's what Robert Epstein, if you're familiar with him, he's done some research on this, and they find that if Google or other platforms use these kind of targeted go vote reminders, this isn't even the censorship, by the way, this is just like targeting go vote reminders, you could increase potentially the election out, like you could increase the number of voters by tens or hundreds of thousands, in some cases millions. One thing I'll say is Facebook, as far back as 2010, did their own internal study where they basically sent users like go vote reminders. They didn't disclose like how they targeted those, but they were targeted. They increased the total number of votes cast by something like, I think it was 340,000. Yeah. Right? That's back in 2010. So think about how how, you know, vastly larger these platforms are, how much more powerful they are in the last 14 years. And I mean, think about that, like how much that ability to turn out votes would increase proportionately. So it's really significant power and something that we should be very concerned with.
Now, in some of these cases, wouldn't this be against federal and state election laws? Because if a company were to promote a political issue or a candidate using these algorithms or AI chatbots or whatever they're using, would that not be considered a campaign donation?
It would be under federal law. And in fact, that's what Hans and I argued in the piece, is that, you know, corporations can support political candidates, but they have to do it through PACs. And that has to be reported to the Federal Election Commission. But what a lot of these companies are doing in the digital age is they're using their power, right, as digital intermediaries of information to essentially go behind the scenes and influence elections and essentially make political donations by boosting certain candidates and content without anyone knowing. And our argument is, look, every other corporation has to live by the rules, right? If any other corporation in any other industry wanted to do the same thing, they'd have to report it. It'd have to be reported as a contribution through a PAC. Big tech companies want to play by their own rules. They want to skirt the law that applies to everyone else. And that's, I think, the definition. That shows you just how out of control these tech monopolies have become. And this is why we have to rein them in.
You know, there's so many different avenues to discuss in this. But if China were to have the American branch of TikTok be sold to an American company, what would prevent China from holding still some influence over that company? Would it be a complete severance of that area, or would China still have some control? Because we know any company here in the United States that does business, or any company that does business in China, must have one member of the Communist Chinese on its board.
Which you bring up an excellent point, and that is that, for instance, Apple, right? So Apple it manufactures many of its products in China. And that gives, we would argue, that's a huge conflict of interest. And it's one of the reasons why Apple has bent the knee to China on multiple occasions. I think it's different, though, when you compare China's ability to influence a company versus China's ability to directly control a company. The status quo is that ByteDance, which owns TikTok, it is a Chinese company. It is completely under the control of the Chinese Communist Party. At least it's under their laws as a company. So there's no, like, if China wants to tell ByteDance to do something by law, ByteDance has no recourse but to do it. In fact, ByteDance has an internal CCP committee inside their own company. And that shows you, I think, the degree of influence that China has when we're talking about a Chinese company versus an American company that happens to have operations in China. Agree that both of those things are bad, but I think it's in terms of the degree of the danger, that the danger is most pronounced under the status quo, where ByteDance, a wholly owned or a wholly Chinese company, is controlling one of the most significant influential social media apps in the world, and especially in America. So that would be the distinction I would draw.
Well, what's to say that Google and all the others don't have China influence in what they're doing now on their social networks?
Well, I'm sure they do. Well, we know as some of them. So Microsoft, for instance, currently has an AI lab in China. We know that's a point of leverage for the Chinese government. That's a problem. But Microsoft's still an American company, right? So they're headquartered here. They are incorporated under the laws of the United States. And that, again, that's still bad that they have, there's Chinese influence, but it's different than a company that is headquartered in China and completely at the beck and call of the Chinese Communist Party, which is essentially the status quo with ByteDance.
Well, then how do we rein in these social networks that deplatform people like you and me and Curtis? How do we rein them in and give the American people their free speech back?
Well, I think it's a multi-tiered approach. I think you start by saying, look, we're going to open up your opaque content algorithms and content moderation policies to public scrutiny. A lot of, like, what did the Twitter files reveal? I think that's a good place to start. It revealed that much of what happened, much of the abuse occurred because no one knew what was going on. Now we know several years later. But imagine if we had known in real time, for instance, that the White House was having conversations with the leadership at Twitter and Facebook and telling them to action certain posts because it was out of step with what the White House's narrative on COVID-19 was. Imagine how that might have changed the conversation around whether, you know, Facebook did that and how the public perceived it. And I think it would have at least been a bulwark against censorship. So I think the first truth is, as Louis Brandeis said, sunlight is the best disinfectant, right? Let's open these processes up to public view. I think the second step is to say that companies shouldn't get special legal immunity for going and censoring constitutionally protected speech. At the Heritage Foundation, we've called for reforming Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which is essentially a provision of law that immunizes large internet platforms from legal liability. So it essentially prevents them from being sued for taking down content. We think that there should be some immunity, but that immunity should only apply to companies that act in good faith. So a company going behind, colluding with the government or left-wing interests to target certain voices or messages, that's not censoring in good faith. That's not filtering in good faith. That's bad faith censorship. And so they shouldn't have liability for that. I think the third thing, and this is something that Texas and Florida have done, is impose common carriage requirements on large social media companies. Now, the Supreme Court is still deciding whether those laws are constitutional. But I think that common carriage should apply to large information intermediaries.
And what is that?
So the common carriage means it's like if you use the telephone, right, and you call your friend, the telephone company can't decide, for instance, to shut down your telephone line if they don't like what you're saying to your friend. That's the basic principle is that the company that allows you to communicate with your friends can't intervene in that communication unless that communication is clearly unlawful. That's the standard that's applied to, before the telephone, it was telegraph. They applied a common carriage to that. And to some extent, we should be applying those same principles to social media companies because they're just advanced versions of those, you know, communications platforms. It's allowing you to communicate with your audience and your friends. So for instance, this podcast or this radio show, right, this is being recorded live. You shouldn't, the companies that distribute this video shouldn't be able to refuse to serve you, right, as the podcast host, if they dislike your political content. So that would be an extension of, it's also called public accommodations, right? In a physical sense, like if you went into a store and let's say the store manager, you wanted to buy a widget and the store manager didn't like that you voted for Joe Biden, the store manager wouldn't be able to deny you service just because he didn't like the fact that you voted for Joe Biden, right? Or Donald Trump for that matter. So that's a sort of common carriage principle in practice.
Wow. There's a lot to digest here, but I do hope that we can get ourselves our acts together here because we do see constantly election interference on all levels. And I mean, when you see Joe Biden with that executive order going out telling all the federal agencies to do get out the vote, and it's going not just from the federal agencies, trickle down into state agencies and associated nonprofits. And you see this left and right where you're paying college kids to register people to vote. There is election interference in so many levels within this administration that I have never seen in my life. I mean, my first vote was for Ronald Reagan. And back then, you saw the newspapers trying to influence the vote with their articles. But this is going to a whole new level. I don't think anyone could have predicted in our founding fathers, especially with the birth of AI. That scares me a lot.
Well, it's a huge issue. And I think, you know, what AI allows is these companies to take their censorship to a whole new level, right? So the reason why some of these platforms are so addictive to kids is because they're using AI to find out what keeps you glued to the platform, right? These platforms are designed to be addictive. That is their purpose. And the reason it's their purpose is that's how they generate ad revenue. The longer you're on their platform, the more data about you they're able to collect and to monetize, meaning they're able to sell it to third parties. So the more your eyeballs are on their services, the more profit they make. And that means that the technology they create is designed to keep you ensnared. Now, that has political implications to your point, because it means that these companies have a business model to rewire people's brains, right? To influence not just what you think, but how you think. And that can be used for political purposes as well as for commercial purposes. And that's what we're seeing over and over, especially in the case of TikTok. In those examples, and you mentioned earlier, Tiananmen Square and the Falun Gong and other, other dissident movements like the Hong Kong democracy demonstrations. Even in here in the U.S., most recently, with all the pro-Palestinian content that was largely boosted on TikTok. TikTok can decide minute to minute what goes viral on their platform. They can change the narrative in a matter of minutes. And that's really a dangerous power for anyone, but especially for our worst adversary, the Chinese Communist Party. They should not have that power here in America, especially in an election year.
Yeah, I mean, so many things are coming to the light of what the Chinese are doing, and the massive illegal immigration that we're finding on the southern border, an untold number of Chinese of military age now entering the United States illegally and destroying their IDs. So when Border Patrol picks them up, they have no idea who these people are. They just have to process them based upon their word. And China's doing anything and everything to find ways. They're going after our infrastructure by trying to attack the networks. And this is just another way to destroy the United States from within. And people don't understand how powerful China is in influencing the American mind. I dare someone to walk into Walmart and find an item made in Walmart that's made in America, not made in China.
No, absolutely. And one last thing I'll say is, So the other problem with TikTok, right? So we talked about the data collection. So it's collecting all this data on users, but China separately has been orchestrating hacks of critical services, right? Here in the U.S. So like Equifax, multiple companies have reported massive leaks or massive hacks. All that information is going to China. So what China's doing, what China's able to do is to compile all the data they're collecting on Americans into dossiers, right? Which is a sort of spy intelligence term for information and profiles on individual citizens. And when they're able to use that to figure out what do we think, how do we tick, how can they influence us? That's the danger of data. Data is a powerful weapon in the hands of foreign adversaries, and China's especially adept at acquiring it, and that's something we need to address, partially through this divestment, but through other legislation as well.
Well, we're down to our last couple of minutes. We're down to our last 2 minutes, and it has been absolutely fascinating, Daniel, between you and my friend Gregory Wrightstone. I'm glad that we can get this message and these words out. And God bless you. And tell Hans I said hello. And hopefully we'll have him on next time too. So thank you, Daniel. And people will find you at heritage.org. God bless.
Take care, Daniel.
All right. Check out Daniel Cochran at heritage.org. I don't even know if we have enough time to do our closing. The show has gone so fast. But we want to thank everyone that showed up in the chat rooms across the board. Our friend Sweet Sue, glad to see her out there. Along with James and the captain. Glad to see everyone that joined us out there. Thank you for the comments. That we were watching it, but I can't respond to everything that was being posted. So that's what you're there for, Curtis, to respond. But we will be back next week. We have Mark Tapscott from the Epoch Times, or Epoch Times, joining us for his bi-monthly visit. But we also have Scott Walter. He's an author, has a new book out there that will scare the ever-loving out of you, called Arabella. And it's about, Arabella is about dark money that has been going to left causes. And it makes George Soros look like a Boy Scout. I mean, this is so insidious, and it is like a spider, and the web is out there. And man, just reading the first couple of chapters in the book, I had to put it down because it was scaring the crap out of me. But we will be back next Friday with our new guests. In some states, early voting is starting real soon. Ours will start next week. So, folks, we have to make sure that we rally our members, our friends and families. If there is early voting and you can do it legally in your state, please go ahead and grab some friends and family to go out and vote for good, solid conservative candidates out there. We need to take back the White House. We need to take control of the Senate and widen our majority in the House. So watch TV tomorrow, because Trump will be on tomorrow at his rally in Wildwood, New Jersey. So with that, I will say good night and God bless.
Be safe.